Well, we hope you've enjoyed and even perhaps been intrigued by some of the quotes and images that are around the room. What we'd like to do right now is give you a little bit of context and a little bit of organization to some of the things that you've seen there. We believe that God has called Campus Crusade for Christ to play a role, even a lead role, in reaching every college student on earth with the gospel. In America, that means about 17 million students, which are represented with these just handful of characters. Some of them are ready to respond in faith to the gospel. If somebody would just love them enough to simply and clearly explain the gospel to them. Others, though, are not ready to respond in faith. Many others are not ready to respond in faith. Someone needs to love them enough to help them get ready. They have views of the world that render them unable to even consider the possibility that Jesus' message is worth hearing and that he's worth getting to know. Their views on truth, sin, sexuality, Christianity, and Christians are such that the gospel message gets no traction in their minds. They don't know how sweet Jesus is. And when we tell them, they're simply not able to hear the message. They need help to even hear the gospel before they can actually consider it and ultimately come to follow him. We'd like to suggest to you that the relative number of students that fall into each of those categories should influence the methodologies that we employ, because the ready and the unready need very different things. The ready need essentially what we've done for decades. Our systems, tools, approaches, and metrics are well designed for a population that is ready to believe the gospel. We are a fantastic harvesting organization, if I do say so myself. We came into existence, and we've been led for decades by men and women who understand harvesting and who've devised approaches well-suited for a ripe audience. When you operate in an environment in which most people are ready, it's wise to do that, and we have wisely chosen to invest in strategies for the ready. But let me show you a simple illustration that kind of sets up some of the skills, perhaps, that one might want to have when they're working with students that need to hear about Christ. The x-axis represents the portion of the gospel message on which we focused. The left side is the reaping message. This is concerned with things like it's endgame evangelism. It's explaining substitutionary atonement. It's calling people to a decision. The right side is a sowing message. That's more of things like Randy Newman's plausibility structures or Tim Keller's defeater beliefs. It's the pre-evangelistic efforts that you need to do to help someone get ready. The y-axis is the modes, and we're familiar with that. The top of the chart is the natural mode of evangelism, and the bottom is ministry mode evangelism. The z-axis here that cuts across is meant to suggest the continuum that exists between proclamation and demonstration, or as we've termed it lately, good words and good deeds, right? Now, because we are who we are, because we're Campus Crusade for Christ, we have historically focused on proclaiming the gospel in ministry mode context to those who are ready to respond in faith. That's who we are. That's who we've been for a long, long time. And throughout our history, because of the environment into which we were born, we've developed this particular expertise. Those are our great strengths, and it's worked famously for decades among the ready. However, those who are not ready to respond to faith in Jesus need us to provide a different service. They need us to be adept at pre-game evangelism. They need us to learn how to sow, how to go after these issues that exist in their mind, the worldview concepts that are a barrier between them knowing Christ and really even being able to understand it. We also need to become more skilled, we're going to suggest, at natural mode evangelism up here. There's strong evidence that suggests that a trusted friend has an easier time of overcoming the issues that exist that keep someone from Christ than a stranger does. And in a culture that is wary of false proclamations of all sorts, we need to learn how to demonstrate the gospel so that by sacrificial acts of love and service, we can establish the plausibility of the gospel message. Now, let me show you this. Dr. Bright said something in 1958 that I think will be familiar to you. Dr. Bright said, "The majority of non-believers throughout the world are ready to receive Christ when properly approached with a clear and simple presentation of the gospel by a spirit-filled witness." Now, we believe that that was true at a particular time in a particular context. And we wonder today, of you in the room, how many believe that that is presently true on the American college campus today? Yeah, we feel the same way. Here's what we'd like to suggest here, that if we were very good at doing what relatively few students need, but we're not very good at doing what an increasing majority of law students need, if that were true, then our skills would be insufficient for our stated mission of reaching every student with the gospel, and we would need to change. In that case, we would need to overcome our habits and our systemic preferences, and we'd have to develop new expertises on the other side of those continuums. And not only that, but if the number of students who are ready to respond to a reaping message proclaimed in a ministry mode context is not only small, but is in fact shrinking, then as an organization, Campus Crusade for Christ would be moving towards obsolescence, and we would need to change. Enough if-then statements. What we'd like to do is show you what we've learned. We were asked, as Jeff explained, to study six research data streams. Let me just briefly mention what those were, and then we'll tell you what we learned from each of them. First thing we were asked to do was to survey our staff. So we conducted an online survey of our staff in October 2009. Carrie helped us do that. We also conducted a number of interviews with unbelievers, focus groups actually, and we did that using a video clip from Seinfeld, in which we sought to kind of solicit from them their thoughts about Christianity and evangelism. You'll get to see that clip in a little bit. We interviewed a whole bunch of new believers from a variety of contexts to understand from them what works, what are the bright spots, how did you come to faith? We also spoke to a number of leaders who are external to Campus Crusade to see what's happening, what we can learn from others that operate outside of our particular context. And then finally, we read a whole bunch of books. We read a number of books about culture and evangelism, and then we read several books about good words and good deeds, that proclamation and demonstration combination. An exhaustive summary of everything that we learned will be available in the reports that you'll get as soon as we're done the main section and before the Q&A, just like the previous group did. But right now, what we'd like to do is share with you the most salient things that we learned. And in brief, we hope to persuade you of three things, all of which I've just suggested may be true, but we'd really like to persuade you are true. And they are this: that the culture has changed, that we have not sufficiently, and that we must. Despite our skills, our history, our resources, our size, if we do not make sweeping changes to the way we approach evangelism, we believe that Campus Crusade for Christ would become unable to genuinely reach the lost in any significant numbers. And over time, we will become increasingly irrelevant as God raises up other organizations to fulfill His Great Commission. The culture has changed. We have not sufficiently, and we must.
Arnold Palmer, Tiger Woods, Bugs Bunny, South Park, Little House on the Prairie, Sex and the City, Husband and Wife, Husband and Husband, Lady Di, Lady Gaga. The culture has changed dramatically, even to the casual observer. More significantly, with this culture change, we Christians have inherited a stunning image problem in our culture, especially in our collegiate culture. For our project, we interviewed unbelievers, believers, outside experts, we surveyed our staff, and we read quite a few books for this. One of the books that we read, one that perhaps some of you have read, is a book called Unchristian by Kinnaman and Lyons, in which what they do is they interview 16 to 29-year-old unbelievers and get their reaction or their perceptions of what they believe Christianity is in our culture. Simply, these young unbelievers think the following of us. They think that we are hypocritical, that we're uncaring. Now, uncaring toward their concerns, they think that we're overly caring about seeking converts, that they think that we are anti-homosexual. In fact, of all of these six, this was the highest scoring category, 91% of unbelievers in this age range say that anti-homosexual accurately defines what they think of with regard to Christianity in America. Number four, that we're sheltered. Number five, we're too political. If you know the answer to this, don't respond if you've read the book. But in a question that they asked to this audience, they said, kind of a word association question, who's the number one person that comes into your mind when you hear the word Christian? Now, let me give you the correct answer. The number one answer was the Pope, who, by the way, has a stunning image problem right now, if you've been reading the news. A very, very close second was George W. Bush, Republican, conservative, politician. Too political is what they're thinking of us. And lastly, judgmental. So again, hypocritical, uncaring, anti-homosexual, sheltered, too political, and judgmental. Ouch. Ouch. Yeah. Perception matters. And perhaps the question we should ask ourselves is, are they right? Are they right? Now, in interviewing unbelievers, our team for this project, one of the questions we asked these groups of unbelievers was the following. We said, how would you prefer a Christian friend to talk with you about Jesus? And here's how some of those unbelieving students responded. I'd prefer, first young man said, I'd prefer they didn't talk to me about Jesus. I'm an adult capable of making my own decisions. Note his starting point, that I will make my own decisions. I don't want your input. I regulate the flow of information coming my way. Another said this, I'm not going to learn what I believe from someone else. We heard this idea over and over, and simply put, we think that what they're saying is, essentially, they believe that their conversational autonomy trumps our initiating compassion toward them. For many, the power to decide when and with whom they will have a discussion about Jesus is a higher concern to them than the notion that we have this compassion towards them in initiating a conversation about him. In that kind of context, we think that presentational approaches may not get that much attraction, especially when you compare that with a kind of a questioning approach or a dialogue type of approach. Now, as part of our research, we showed this two-minute video clip that we're going to see here in just a second that Tim referred to. It's a Seinfeld clip. We showed it to these unbelieving students, and then we asked them a series of questions afterward. Let me just set it up by saying it's Elaine and her boyfriend. His name is Putty. She discovers that, lo and behold, he's a Christian. Okay? So roll the tape.
It feels like an Arby's thing.
Do you believe in God?
Yes.
Oh, so you're pretty religious.
Not true.
So is it a problem that I'm not really religious?
Not for me.
Why not?
I'm not the one going to hell.
Well, I'm going to hell.
Seems about right.
Hey, you heard the one about the guy in hell with the coffee and the donuts?
I'm not in the mood.
I want some coffee and a donut.
I know, but he does.
So it's more of a relationship problem than the final destination of your soul.
No, relationships are very important to me.
Maybe you can strike one up with the Prince of Darkness as you burn for all eternity.
And a slice of devil's food cake.
Hey, I forgot to deliver your paper today. Why don't you just grab that one?
But that belongs to Mr. Potato Guy. That's his.
Come on, get it.
Well, if you want it, you get it.
Sorry, I shall not steal.
Oh, but it's okay for me.
What do you care? You know where you're going.
You should care that I'm going to hell, even though I am not.
You stole my Jesus fish, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that's pretty funny now, wasn't it? Come on. One question we asked after the students watched this videotape, we asked, now Elaine says to Putty in the middle of this, if you think that I'm going to hell, you should care that I'm going to hell. Surprisingly, many of the respondents, these students that we interviewed, many of them thought it was inappropriate for Putty to try to save her. Listen to what some of them said. Quote, he should not try to convert her. Another, he put that bad idea into her head about going to hell, and that's the real problem. Another, I wouldn't care if I was dating someone of another faith, I wouldn't try to convince her. And last, if Elaine wanted help to be saved, then and only then could Putty help. The initiative had to begin with her and not with Putty. The strength of these opinions surprised us. Today's collegians have legitimized Putty's apathy as the correct formula. Something that just 15 years ago, Jerry Seinfeld, a Jewish comedian, would have absolutely disagreed with. The culture has changed that much. Now, in interviewing outside experts for our research, we interviewed Ralph Ennis. Ralph is the director of intercultural training and research for the Navigators. Phenomenal guy who was just here this week with us. We interviewed him. He told us that he has stopped using the bridge illustration entirely when he shares the gospel with someone, a traditional presentational approach. Here's what Ralph had to say. Ralph said, quote, our audience has taken three steps away from my starting point. This is a difficult culture to minister in. The majority of the culture is turned off. A very interesting observation by Ralph, but the real question is, why? Why is that? Finally, in our research with our own Campus Crusade staff, some of them commented on the very difficult realities of evangelistic effectiveness in this changed culture that we're living in. When asked this question, what is the most frustrating thing about the evangelistic activity in which you've been a part in the past year? Here's what some of them said. One of our MTLs said this. Let me get this up for you here. One of our MTLs said, not a single student has received Christ as a result of an evangelistic activity that I've been involved in during the last 12 months. I'm well aware that it is the Holy Spirit that changes hearts, but I have a growing frustration and sadness over my inability to lead a team in fruitful ministry. Another, most students simply don't care about spiritual things, especially Christ. It's not even an active or a reasoned opposition. It's just their feeling that it doesn't have any possible bearing on their lives. Now, conversely, when we asked what's the most satisfying and effective evangelistic activity you've been involved in the last year, we actually had one of our staff simply say, I can't think of one. Another said this, our staff and our students desperately need help in understanding why the gospel seems so irrelevant to so many, particularly in the university environment. As I turn this back over to Tim, let me say this again. We have a stunning image problem. The culture has changed, but have we?
When you ponder Dan's question, have we changed, you may be able to think of several things that are new in our evangelistic toolkit. Cojourners and solarium come to mind as elements that are well suited to the needs of the hour. And even the thing that we dream about, movements everywhere so that everyone knows someone who truly follows Christ, that implies the value of a relational mode of evangelism, a natural mode of evangelism. And we would agree and we rejoice in all of those things. However, on the basis of our research, we would say that we have not changed nearly enough, at least not yet. There are other stronger factors that keep us in orbit around our own traditions, traditions that we developed while learning how to reach a culture that no longer exists. In our skill set, we have simply not kept pace with the rate and the degree of change necessary to reach every student with the gospel. Let me tell you what our staff are telling us about this. We conducted a survey in October 2009, and in it we asked questions about sowing and reaping. For the purposes of that survey, we distinguish between sowing and reaping like this. We define sowing as sowing activities could include building relationships, exploring worldviews, and addressing perspectives that keep someone from ever considering the gospel. Reaping activities could include explaining the gospel itself and calling people to a decision. Okay? Then having established those two categories, we ask them about what they feel they have permission to do and what they believe to be the next best step for the typical lost student on their campus. Okay? So what we were looking for, we wanted to know is the staff experiencing a convergence between what they believe the organization wants from them and what they believe the lost need from them. Okay? Here's what we learned. They told us staff agreed or strongly agreed that they have permission to spend their time on reaping activities. 92% of our staff said, yes, I have permission to spend my time on reaping activities. That's, of course, not a surprising figure. That's what we do, right? When we asked the same question, do you feel you have permission to spend your time on sowing activities? The figure dropped to 53%. Roughly half of our staff feel they have permission to spend their time on sowing activities. Now, let me pause there for 1 second to observe, in fact, they do have permission to spend their time on sowing activities. And there is, we believe, we can make a very strong case that they do. But the issue here is that they are not experiencing that permission. They don't think that they do. They don't feel that they do. And we believe that that's a significant reality, even though, in fact, they do have permission. They're not experiencing it. Having asked that, we also asked, to what extent do you believe that the next best step for the typical lost student on your campus is sowing activities? And the answer was 78%. 78% of our staff agreed or strongly agreed the next best step for the typical lost student on their campus is sowing. And then we asked that question, next best step for lost students, to what extent is that reaping? 38%. So agreed or strongly agreed that the next best step is reaping. What that means, if you kind of ponder those figures a minute, what that means is that roughly half of our staff believe they have permission to do what most think is the right thing to do. And about one-third of our staff believe that they are supposed to do not the right thing. Only half of our staff feel permission to do what they believe they're supposed to do. We were asked to research our staff's satisfaction and effectiveness in evangelism. And we believe that those figures provide a pretty significant key to the relative dissatisfaction of our staff when it comes to evangelism. So those are some of the numbers. Let me show you a few comments from the surveys. And let me mention, too, that when we asked the questions in the survey, we never once mentioned our success criteria or asked any questions about our statistics in any way. And yet, they were mentioned repeatedly in the essay questions as our staff tried to explain why they don't feel permission to spend their time on sewing. Here's what some of our staff said. Quote, I feel the culture has shifted and we are missing the mark with our evangelistic effort. Lots of conversations, little fruit. Something is off. Please help. Others said, stats don't account for building relationships. Just gospel presentations. What the organization asks for statistically reflects what we value. And then this. Another staff member said, even though sowing is something that people say is good and acceptable, much of everything else in our ministry screams that it is not. Our stats are reaping only. Almost all of our training is for randoms, which end up equipping our students to do something that has almost no relevancy to them after college. We believe that those numbers and those comments are telling an important story, despite the way forward and the very clear call from our national and regional leadership to do whatever it takes to reach our campuses for Christ. There remains in our staff's mind a tether to a particular way of doing things. Our own rich history, our metrics, pride in our own courage, the way that evangelism is trained and modeled, a big break, the stories that we tell and celebrate, and maybe just the tendency to revert to doing what we know, are all exerting a gravitational force that is greater than all these other things. Our staff can't break free from it, even as they see it's not working anymore. Friends, the culture has changed, and we have not, at least not sufficiently, which is why we believe we must. We must. We believe, on the basis of our research, there is an urgent need to realign our evangelistic skills and our evangelistic practices to better match the needs of the hour. there's more than we have time to say about all of this, but we just want to share a couple more lessons from two additional streams that we haven't really mentioned so far. Our research with new believers and our conversations with external leaders. Probably, I would say, for me at least, the most joyful part of our research was sitting down with all the new believers and just asking them to tell the stories. It was incredibly fun. We talked to new believers from various campuses, various ethnicities, folks that came to Christ through Campus Crusade and through other people and organizations. And I sat down myself one-on-one with a bunch of new believers at Penn State who had come to Christ either through Crusade or through the Navigators or through a local church ministry. And I just asked them to tell me the story. How did you come to meet Jesus? And then I just sat back and we just listened to them tell us what had happened. And it was just incredible. It's so fun. It would be a great exercise, even if you're not doing a research project, just to listen and be encouraged as kid after kid told us how they fell in love with Jesus and learned, of course, that he loves them more than they love him. It was just sweet to listen to them talk about how they met Jesus and how he saved them. I remember leaving. I walked away from the hub, which is the student union at Penn State. And I did all of these interviews in a single afternoon. And so I just had them all lined up one right after the other. And so I was somewhat weary by the end of the day. But my heart was just full of worship. You know, I mean, how could it not be after you hear kid after kid talk about how much they love Jesus and how much he loves them? And there was all sorts of variety as I listened to their stories, all kinds of different things I heard. But one thing unified their stories, and that was this. They all, every one of them, came to Christ through multiple ongoing interactions with a trusted friend. They all had issues they needed to overcome. They all had misconceptions about Jesus. They had, in some cases, an antipathy towards Christians, an unwillingness to repent. But the one thing that unified every single one of the people that I spoke to, and 95% of the students that my colleagues spoke with, was that in 95% of the conversations we had, it was a trusted friend who helped them overcome those barriers and led them to faith in Christ. You guys, what we find is that a natural approach is one that works in this culture. And we believe that we need to invest much more of our energy in becoming experts and helping our students become experts in a natural mode of evangelism. And we believe that we need to develop that expertise not only so that we can employ it, but also so that we can share it. While we were conducting research among the external leaders, I had the privilege to speak to David Bisgrove. David Bisgrove is the pastor of evangelism at Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City. And knowing that Keller is so good at pre-evangelistic, sowing, defeat or belief, addressing evangelism, we wanted to know, how do you train your people to do evangelism? What does that look like at Redeemer? And Bisgrove was fantastic. I loved talking to him. But do you want to guess what the core evangelistic strategy is at Redeemer? That's it. That is exactly right, Carrie. The answer is you invite your friends to come to an event where Tim Keller or some other genius is doing the talking, and they'll take it from there, right? That's what they do. And I told Bisgrove, you know, that's not going to work for us, right? We don't use the talented genius model, right? That's just never been our approach. Our job, no offense, right? But listen, right, but listen, our job, is it not our job to take the gospel in all of its beauty? Keith's our talented genius, but he doesn't work at Penn State, right? To take the gospel in all of its beauty, all of its simplicity and its sophistication, and put it in the hands of a sophomore, right? That's what we do. You have to think about it. If Mark Driscoll dies in a car accident, will Mars Hill continue to be the force for change that it is? What's going to happen to Desiring God when John Piper dies? Without Keller, would Redeemer be a Redeemer? We don't have that liability, right? Our genius is dispersed. Our genius is dispersion. We are all about transferability. This is us, right? You ever seen this picture before? That's the heart of Campus Crusade for Christ right there. Right? This is who we are. We equip armies of 19-year-olds to share their faith, and therefore transferability is everything to us. That's why we're experts at transferability. I explained that to David Bisgrove, and he said, well, if you figure out how to make this stuff transferable, then let us know. And essentially, what he's saying is that, when he told me a story, he said that they have a heart, as low as the bar is, They have a hard time getting their people to invite their friends to come to these events. And so they did research to find out, why is it? I mean, it's so easy. Just bring your friend. We'll do everything. And the reason that their friends, that their people don't invite their friends is they know after the event, their friend is going to turn to them and ask a question that they don't know how to answer. And they don't want to feel stupid. So they don't do it. And essentially what Bisgrove was asking me to do is to help them train their people to use their material. Because that's who we are. That's what we do. And when I was having that conversation, my mind went back to something that Keller said at CSU. Do you remember when he said that if Campus Crusade ceased to exist, the church would have to reinvent us tomorrow? Remember that? Well, I don't know exactly what he had in mind, but I suspect that what he may have been thinking about was our genius at transferability. This is what we do. We equip sophomores to share their faith. I think it's because we think so hard about making these things accessible to young believers that we have been a major player in equipping the church. But in this task of doing effective evangelism here and now, we don't have that much to transfer because we don't know how to do it, at least not yet. We need to change so that we can do what works in our own ministry and so that we can take what we learn, run it through our transferability machine, and help equip the church how to make a very sophisticated approach work in the hands of an average believer. The church needs us to apply our expertise in transferability. If we don't do it, who will? It's what God has raised us up to do. We need to change. We need to invest heavily in strategies that work in this culture, as long as they continue to work, and then we'll need to change again. And we need to make what we learn transferable so that anybody can do it. It's what God raised us up to do. We believe that we need to change if we are to fulfill our purpose. So, the culture's changed. We have not sufficiently, and we must.
So how do we change? Let me share with you guys six things that we can do to change, and then Dan's going to come up and wrap us up. Now, I'm going to go through these quickly, and then you'll get a chance to get a copy of our research proposal, and it'll walk through these with more depth. The first thing that we need to do is affirm permission to sow. Our staff need to know that it's valuable. Our staff need to know and understand that they have permission. Now, again, we know that they have permission, but from our staff survey, they don't feel like they have permission. And so we need to take advantage of our staff conferences, our staff planning times, and other platforms to let our staff know that the creative value for sowing activities. Another thing we need to do is adjust the paradigms. We need to create structures on our campuses where staff and students know that we're going after this group of people. Now, we do a great job on our campuses at raising up students and sending them to unreached places across the world, but the reality is our students aren't reaching these unreached students who are sitting right across from them in their classrooms. The same students that are going aren't reaching the unreached on their own campuses. And so we need to create structures to where they can do evangelism and go after this people group and not just those on the upper level, the blue, because what we have a tendency to do is create a structure that creates a Christian bubble on campus so that by the time you're a senior, your week's full of crusade activities. And then you huddle up in the Christian bubble, and then you leave the Christian bubble, and you do the evangelism, and you reach some of these people, and then you run back to the Christian bubble, and you huddle up again. And that's what evangelism often looks like on our campuses. And what we need to do is create structures that break those bubbles, that allow us to go after the campus. Now, something that Tim Henderson's done at Penn State is created a new leadership role called a missionary. And what a missionary does is just like a missionary would do overseas. What they do is they incarnate themselves in a pocket on campus in one of these people groups and do natural evangelism within that people group. And so we need to adjust our paradigms to make sure that we could reach everyone. We also need to align our metrics. We need to make sure that we have metrics that reflect that we can create these structures, that they're valuable to go after, that we need to count what our staff and students are doing in evangelism holistically, not just in ministry mode. It's like this. A great analogy is to think of it as football. We staff feel like we value touchdowns, but can we create metrics that would value first downs along the way? Because what it feels like the coaches are calling in Hail Marys all the time instead of plays that can get us further along down the field. And so we need to align our metrics to make sure that staff feel permission to go after sowing activities. A fourth thing we need to do is accelerate transferability. We need to make sure, well, two things that our team came up with that we feel like we need to do to this culture. Number one, we feel like we need an invisible tool. Number two, we need a dialogical approach for that tool. And we also recognize that because we're training 19-year-olds to do this, that we've got to make it quick and we got to make it clear when we do it. So one of the things that we've done, one example is in the proposals you'll be getting, is we've created a flashcard based off of the Tim Keller's Reason for God book. And what we need to do is we want to help deconstruct a worldview and reconstruct it in a way that the gospel makes sense to them. And so we want to address what are the defeater beliefs? What are the beliefs that are keeping these students from even hearing the gospel in the first place? So in this scenario, the defeater belief is there can't just be one true religion. That's something that college campuses we face all the time. And what this is designed to do is help train a student in how to have dialogue with someone who's not a Christian and how they could respond to various perspectives or worldviews that someone has. And so it's designed, again, to be a dialogue. And we believe that an approach like this would be useful in helping to train students so that they can take on more of a sowing approach. And again, we feel like that if we do this here, that our graduating seniors will be in a much better place to do evangelism after they graduate. I had an alumni who's involved in ministry drive me to the airport before I came here, and I had asked him how many of his, has he tried to reach out to his neighbors? And he hadn't surveyed any of his neighbors. He hadn't whipped out any. That's just not as transferable in the real world. And so we want to train them in ways that'll be more transferable so that we can, again, reach more of these people. Let me hear up. We need to also assist with compassion. Our organization's rally cry is the Great Commission. And we emphasize go, but teaching them to observe all things involves a whole lot of social justice issues. And God's heart is for these social justice issues. And we need to align our hearts with God's hearts, as well as recognizing that we live in a service-oriented culture. So there are a lot of non-Christians, unbelievers in this culture that are service-oriented. And our message isn't sticking because they don't perceive us as caring. And so we need to assist with compassion. And again, our research proposal will have a lot of ideas in here on how we could do that. The last and most importantly, we need to aspire to dependence. We need to aspire to dependence on God. We can make all these changes in our ministry and fail miserably. God is the one that we have to rely on. If the spiritual climate on the campus is cold, we need God to turn up the temperature. And so we need to remember, just as Dr. Bright, I remember some of being in the president's office back in 2000 and having him talk about your first love. Don't forget your first love. Don't forget it's about the Holy Spirit working through you. We have to remember this. It's about God. We must change. We believe that we need to make these changes to be more effective in evangelism. The great evangelist Paul once said, "For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all that I might win the more of them." And then he runs through this familiar list and talks about the various connections he has with people and wraps up like this. "I have become all things to all people that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel that I might share with them in its blessing." We need to affirm permission to sow. It needs to feel valued by our staff. We need to adjust the paradigm so that there's a structure where they can do it. We need to align the metrics so that we can measure and celebrate and value those changes. We need to accelerate transferability so that we can pass the torch on and on. We need to assist with compassion so that we can more serve like Christ. And we need to aspire to dependency, continue to rely on God for the results.
Thank you, Roy. Well, as I begin to close, what I'd like to do is ask a final question. Here's my question. Does anyone here know the largest retail chain in American history? Anyone?
Yes.
Correct. It is. Eric is Eric is exactly right. Well, he got it a little wrong. It's actually the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company. It really is. It's not McDonald's, Apple, Walmart, Target. Product placement over here. We have Starbucks coffee cup over there. It wasn't that. It really was. That was total product placement. It was the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, founded in 1859. One little outlet. Oh, by the way, you might know them by a slightly more common name, although, frankly, not that common today. A&P, a grocery store. Yeah. The largest in American history. At its zenith, they had almost 16,000 retail outlets in the United States. Amazing. They're still in business today. A&P, the biggest and the best, and in America's past. I was speaking with my mom recently on the telephone. My mother is 91 years young. You would be blessed to spend time with her. She's a gem. When I was on the phone with her, I said, "Hey, Mom, did you ever shop at an A&P? And she said, "Well, of course I did, Danny." That's our secret. "Of course I did, Danny. When you were just a boy, I would put you in your little red wagon, and I would pull you the 6 to 8 blocks down to 65th and Blue Mound to shop at the A&P." And when she said that, I was like, "You're right. I'd forgotten it was there. Right at 65th and Blue Mound, just past Danny O'Donohue's house, where I used to hang out a lot." I said, "Mom, tell me about it." She said, "I liked it. It wasn't a big store. It didn't have everything, but it had everything that you needed." She went on to talk about their 8 o'clock brand coffee, which they, by the way, spun off and sold, which is still in existence. She talked how my brother Jim, my eldest brother, was a bagger there in high school to make his way through, make a little money. You know, that A&P went out of business, just like 15,000 other A&Ps. What happened? Let me show you. A&P began, like I said, in 1859. By 1910, the A&P was remarkably up to 350 retail outlets. Not bad. By 1930, nearly 16,000 outlets. 1950, today, 429. 110 actually go by the name A&P. The balance of those go by slightly different names than A&P, but still under their ownership. What happened to A&P? Well, here's the answer. America changed. After the Great Depression and two world wars, affluence came to the United States. So we had automobiles now parked out in front of every house. Automobile that can go to the store, pick up a lot of groceries, bring them on home. So you don't have to shop every other day like my mom did. You don't have to pull little Danny home anymore. Just throw him in the back. Refrigerators and freezers in every home, and big ones, right? Big ones. Bulk storage. The suburbs. Everybody moved out to the suburbs. The A&P model was to have these local grocery stores every mile or so within the centers of cities. And now everyone had moved out to the suburbs, or at least they wanted to go out to the suburbs. So American values changed. We didn't want to pull Danny in that little red wagon anymore every other day, so we wanted to instead load up our car, drive from our spacious suburban home all the way to that enormous, giant, mega Kroger's that has everything that you can imagine in that store. Buy it all, load it up for the 1 week or 2 weeks, and then store it in our huge freezers back home. So what happened? America changed. Number two, A&P didn't change with the culture. The last founding family member of A&P died in 1951. Yes, I recognize that's an important year in our culture, 1951. He and his family built the A&P from the very beginning to its great zenith. His name was Mr. John Hartford, and he was affectionately known throughout the company as Mr. John. Now, he died in 1951. His successor absolutely feared changing the business model. And so he lived by the motto consistently, "What would Mr. John do?" So his current problems, he would address them with the phrase, "What would Mr. John do?" The problem, of course, is what Mr. John would do would be good, back in 1933, not in 1955. So the culture changed, and his old ideas were no longer relevant. What they needed wasn't his old ideas. What they needed was Mr. John's same foresight, dedication, and imagination. Campus Crusade for Christ. We have a Mr. John. He was Dr. Bright. He's a great man. But, you know, we don't need his old approaches, which were cutting edge in his day. Right? What we do need is his same foresight, dedication, and imagination to address our current realities. I think that's what he would want for us. So we respectfully submit as we end here that our proposals, as we read through these, will help us move in that direction. Thank you. Now the team's going to come up.
If you don't mind flipping over to table of contents, and the tabs on the side are pretty self-explanatory. The first 15 pages really addresses our problem, our research, and our proposals. The analysis of our proposals, our full reports, and implementing our proposals. So really exhort you with all the hours that we've spent preparing this that you take it and you spend some time digesting it and reading it. Also want to mention that a major component of what we'd like to see happen is a continuing dialogue about these things. There's a website that's been put together, changingevangelism.org, and it's actually right behind me. So there's a place on there that you can get the full report and download parts of it as well, and hopefully have some dialogue on that website. So really, take some time and look through it. Does anybody have any questions or comments or stones you want to throw or disagreements? Love to hear from you. So,
well, I loved about 98% of what you presented. That's a high percentage. I loved it, and I'm in agreement with that much. The part where I went, where it raised questions, is in the definition of sowing and reaping. They seemed at the far edges, where there seems to be a middle that seemed to be missing. And that's only in the definitions that were given. You know, in the book, it may be broader than what was, you know, was stated. But here's my question. As you're focused on the audience needs and what they want and how they want to be engaged by Christians or not engaged by Christians, what is your proposal about helping them understand some of the Tim Keller training, you know, of how to answer those questions that unbelievers have, or how to take down some of those roadblocks that might be in unbelievers' hearts, or what they're wondering about, or what they don't know about God, that comes before the gospel, but it still is about God. Do you follow me? So I'm curious if you have a plan on how to equip students with that. I'm sorry that was so long.
That's great. Actually, let's address that in two parts, if that's all right, Marilyn. So let's talk about the difference of sowing and reaping, and maybe some definition of that, and then we can answer the proposal for how we can, you know, help 19-year-olds figure out how to do that. So which one of you guys would like to talk about that? Tim, you want to start?
Sure,
happy to. Yeah, you know, it was interesting when we conducted the survey on the staff. That was the point at which we were confronted with coming up with definitions for sowing and reaping. And what was interesting about that is we have all sorts of shorthand for reaping, right? Because we do that. If we talk about going, sharing, you know exactly what I mean. And so we found it was difficult to come up with, is there a quick, tight, commonly understood way to talk about the different, you know, effects of that would be involved in a sowing sort of approach? I used a couple phrases up front here about Randy Newman's plausibility structures, which should be very helpful if you've read Randy Newman's book, and completely worthless if you haven't. Even Tim Keller's Defeater Beliefs. Well, great if you've listened to his messages on that, and not helpful if you haven't. So we really struggle to see, is there a common language about those things? And I think the answer is, at this moment, no, which is part of the problem that we're trying to address. So in that, I would observe two things. One, when you're trying to define something, it's helpful to move to the perimeters, to the edges. This is essentially sewing. And yet, we try to suggest, and perhaps not adequately with that chart, that it's not a binary flip. It's a continuum from here sliding into here. So we do define it at the boundaries, but we absolutely recognize that there's a range. And in fact, you could be sewing while you're reading the Four Spiritual Laws to somebody. There's an effect of which you're putting that out there, not necessarily with the intention of getting to a conversion moment in that, but there's a sowing effect that takes place when we sow the seed of the gospel, right? So there's a range, but we felt like in a short way on a survey that we know we only have staff's attention for about 2 minutes. How do we get in and get out and be clear? That was the way we chose to address that, if that's helpful to you.
Okay, let me, I have a comment about that too. I think you look at the, it's XY, what's the up and down word?
Wise.
Yeah. Okay. So you look at the natural mode, and we operate almost exclusively. Not this is an overstatement a little bit, but what we think about almost exclusively is ministry mode, and we would probably put natural and sewing together, right? I mean, when you're sitting around and you're have a 19-year-old playing Xbox at 2 o'clock in the morning, it's probably not going to be a ministry mode of evangelism that they're engaging in, so. So I think, how do we incorporate something intentional so it's not just, oops, I accidentally got to a point to where I could share the gospel, but that we're involving some intentionality, so some transferability is how we would say it, in the natural mode. So there's kind of a crossover in that upper right section. Does that make sense, Marilyn? Good. That's good feedback. Do you have something else?
Well, I could respond to the second part of your question, I think. If I understand you, Marilyn, I think the second part of your question is the global. Okay, how do we do all of this, right? And, my experience would be that there's not a single answer. There's never a silver bullet, as much as we would love there to be one. How do you go after, like, the defeater beliefs in somebody's life? Well, there is an intellectual approach, and that is, you go through the whatever the apologetic issue is for that, and there's great value in doing that. Another approach is you don't do it at all. You simply love them. Invite them out to dinner, and magically, as they feel loved, those things change, right? That's the whole, I'm sure you're familiar with the concept of, do they belong before they believe, or do they believe before they belong? And there's a number of ways to answer that question. I spoke to a friend of mine who works with the Navigators and asked, how do you help your students go after these pretty sophisticated intellectual issues? And the answer was, we don't, in his particular context, is that they just take a much more of a relational approach. And so they're kind of using affection to do an end run around the intellectual issues. Now you have to circle back eventually. We don't want to just raise a bunch of believers that have no intellectual understanding of the truth of the gospel. But the sequencing of those effects can I think is debatable how we can do that. So Roy showed one tool, the transferable tool. One problem that we believe exists with the Reason for God is that you read it and you're done. You think Tim Keller's a genius. But that's all you think. You can't do it. You can't actually turn around and utilize those arguments. The purpose of those flashcards is to help take the, again, it's. I'm a campus crusader. I'm all about transferability. How do I take those concepts and make them transferable so that a sophomore can actually digest these concepts and be capable of using them in a real-life conversation? And to my great pleasure, we've seen that begin to happen. We've used those cards at Penn State. You'll see in the proposals there, we flesh out each of the proposals, the tab is about implementing the proposals, the section on transferability. There's a letter in there that I got from one of our students, Terry. Terry just came to Christ within the last year. She's one of our missionaries. And like 2 days after we did the training on how to use these cards, well, you don't use the cards. You read the cards. You learn the cards. And then you have a real-life conversation. That's what Roy meant by an invisible tool. You're not going to sit down and go through this with somebody. You just learn it, pack it in your head. And like within 2 days, she had a student, a sorority girl that she's friends with, ask her, well, there can't really just be one true religion. And she was amazed. It was almost as if Jesus was real and was superintending this conversation and knew that she was trained and handed her the ball, right? And she was ecstatic. And so we hope to see more of that sort of thing occur.
Yes, sir.
I'm Dave. This is a thanks. You did a great job, team. So, but it's kind of a follow-up question on the transferability. I'm intrigued by your comments on that. And I know that you've identified one of the critical skills, you know, that needs to be addressed in terms of transferability. I wonder if you, in some of your thoughts and research, have come up with some other critical issues in that are affecting our ability to be transferable and get the gospel into, say, the hands of the sophomores, other than just the lack of perhaps critical skills in sewing or some other. Well, you put together a tool to deconstruct some of the thought processes or objections to the gospel. And that I'm assuming, or I think what I've heard, is that that is an omission in terms of our toolbox for transferability. I think what I'm asking is, do you have other things that you would recommend in the toolbox that are missing in terms of transferability?
One of the things that's in this report basically is explaining to some campuses how they can do more good news, good deeds type concepts. I work for Global Aid Network, and right now in the Mid-Atlantic region, we're partnering with Steve Baker and some other universities in that area to bring good news and good deeds to their area so the students can get involved. Now, that's just one of our six streams that we studied, but just so you know, there's three or four pages of just general ideas for their toolbox. If they've never done any good news, good deeds type events, we can help brainstorm with them. Of course, they can always partner with Global Aid Network, just another division of Campus Crusade. So that is one thing we've put in the toolbox here, but I think we have some more in some of the other streams.
You want me? Okay. So, again, that Marilyn and your question are both very similar. They're very broad. Okay, how do we actually do this? I think you'll find in the report a number of additional thoughts on implementing the proposals. Things that I would say that help with the transferability is not just the deconstructing a worldview. That's what would be those cards. But also, okay, how do you communicate the gospel in clear and simple terms? That's still a great value. One of the things that we found with the missionaries that we have at Penn State, this group of leaders, is that some of them have come through what we would call kind of an evangelism 101. How to share the four laws, how to use a quest survey, how to use Solarium, those sorts of things. And then for them, we're moving into kind of evangelism 201, which is, okay, how do you do this in a relational context? Some of our missionaries jumped right into 201, and they don't have the 101 class. They don't know. Well, I had a girl, her name is Jane, she's just wonderful. And she had this great conversation, she's interacting with these kids, and she realized, okay, now this is it, we're there. I don't know what to say. Because she skipped 101, right? And we believe there's enormous value in continuing our fundamental training on evangelism. So I wouldn't say a part of our toolkit, and this perhaps is obvious, but so that you know that we know this, part of the toolkit is our existing toolkit. Those basic skills of communicating the gospel clearly and simply are of great value. So we need to continue to have expressive tools like that. We need to, I think, the backstory, the latest kind of reiteration kind of life at large. I haven't personally experimented with that yet, but we believe that sort of thing is going to be helpful. I personally have a strong preference towards invisible tools. My experience has been that reading to literate people has a fundamental awkwardness to it, right? So we want, I think, you know, we ask our students to memorize the four laws. Go back to the pre-four laws when it was the four laws on a napkin, right? Back in the day, you know, before Dr. Wright had the thing printed, there was just you got to memorize this outline and then be able to deliver it on command. We think there's an awful lot of value to that. So there's a whole range of things. You know, creating a paradigm on your campus in which you're being taught and learning a broad set of skills. So we're asking our students to read pretty broadly on these things. As part, if you join the missionary lane, there's the you're giving implied consent that you're going to read a whole bunch of books because we want them to learn those, you know, variety of skills.
Tom, I'll be right there. I'm just going to go in a little bit different direction. I think a large part of what our skill set needs to include is what our expectation is. One of my staff interviews, which actually kind of it's overstating what it really was, is a friend that came over to dinner at our house that I haven't seen in a number of years. And she's I didn't ask her if I could share the story, so I'm going to be careful a little bit. But she's in a region of the country where it's very cold to the gospel. We have the Northeast and Northwest, so it's one of those two sides. So, you know, and the expectation for her in her context in the campus ministry is that she does all the things that everybody does in the Red River region and everybody does in every region, and it just doesn't work. It doesn't work the same. What her experience is that I need to have permission to sit down for a year and a half with the gay community and be a friend to them. And there is no tool on the planet that is going to prepare somebody to be able to do that other than the love of Christ, first of all. And second of all, being involved in an organization where it says we're proud of you for doing that and celebrate. There's a celebration on some level for her doing that. So I think that's taken it a little bit different direction because, you know, we're talking about tools, and that's good. We need that because we do need to put it in the hands of 19-year-old students. However, it's not the sole answer. I think that's the other side of our research is that the expectation is that we're doing things like we've always done them. And maybe if we throw new tools at it, something will shake loose and it'll be better. But really, it's a new tool and perhaps maybe better expectations for this culture. So took it a little different direction. Anybody else have something to say? Tom's got a question. Okay. Thanks.
What are you experiencing or what are you experiencing when you share with any ethnic group, but let's say African-American students, do you find the response similar? And what have you learned?
Great question. Roy, Dan, no. Tom, I don't work a lot with African-American students. In Texas now, we're the minority. White people are the minority to Hispanics. So there's a large Hispanic movement. And it's a huge difference. And, you know, I can't speak exactly to that, but maybe the other ethnic group that we're having a large impact with is that they are very, very responsive to proclamation. So it's almost like going back 25 years. And all you have to do is show them that you care about them and share the four spiritual laws, and they respond. It's amazing, actually. Makes me wonder why I'm not doing it. You know, it works. So do you have something? Do you have a follow-up question with that, Tom?
No.
Go ahead, Tim.
Only this. We did not ask specific questions about that in the staff survey, but in the essay questions where there's a freedom to respond as you wish, that did come up. And a handful of folks observed that that some of these observations are perhaps limited to the white student population. And in other ethnic groups, there is some of our classic techniques still have much greater effectiveness. So I think that's an important observation.
Yeah, that had been my
Okay, well, I'm intrigued by putting together what was presented a little bit this morning. They used the diffusion of ideas curve of how ideas settle in. You, Tim, in your presentation, you mentioned that we've changed. You say we have not changed, and then you kept qualifying, or you said a couple times, at least sufficiently. So I'm curious if from your perspective, your research and all, do you feel like the ministry is in a process of change and there's something that's holding us back that we have to change more? Is it revolutionary change, evolutionary change? You know, what's needed if we are changing, and maybe we're not at all. I'm trying to get a handle on, are you suggesting something revolutionary, evolutionary? We're in process, we just have to accelerate and go a lot farther, or...
Thanks, Scott. Yeah, I would say, in brief, I would say we are changing, but not nearly fast enough. And I would say we are a good decade late to the party, 15 years late to the party. So while perhaps it could have been done in an evolutionary way, I don't think there's, frankly, I don't think there's time for that. I think we need revolutionary change at this point. Be my brief answer, given that we don't have much time.
Which would require what?
Well, I think that's what we're trying to suggest in the proposals that we've given.
We believe those
six things. And so perhaps one of the fastest ways to speed that up, I think that if anything is holding us back, I think perhaps is the first point, a firm permission to sow, is the way we phrased it there. That our leadership does a great job of communicating well, I think. I mean, we can always improve in lots of different ways. And I've spoken with you about communicating and over-communicating organizational clarity. And perhaps we could do that more. But the same sort of effort that's been given to different initiatives in Campus Crusade in the last, you know, decade, let's say, I would love to see a full-on evangelistic thrust, like we've seen with the Way Forward, where it's communicated at CSU, where it's communicated. I would love to sound the alarm. I'd love you to sound the alarm, and to say that fundamentally there needs to be a revolution. That would be what I would ask for. And again, I'm very time conscious, but I believe perhaps the urgency of this very second is not unlike the urgency in the culture. That I think we're in a bad place. I think we're very, very far behind where we need to be in acquiring the skills to reach this generation.